From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And what a difference a day makes. A man whose name few Americans knew yesterday may well be a name all Americans will hear about for decades. I'm talking about Judge Neil Gorsuch, President Donald Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court. Gorsuch is currently a judge on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us now with more. Hi, Nina.
Hi there.
And a lot of people trying to figure out exactly who this guy is. Many have described Gorsuch as a strong conservative, like the justice he would be succeeding, the late Antonin Scalia. And others, like law professor Doug Kamek, see him as more like Justice Kennedy, the swing vote on the court. What do we know about him and his philosophy as a judge?
I think we know pretty clearly he's much closer to Justice Scalia. That's his record. He's a very distinguished and cerebral judge on the Tenth Circuit who has taken positions, you know, some of them are different than what you might expect from Scalia, but sometimes they're more conservative than Scalia was.
Hmm.
So on any social issues that he's actually ruled on, for example, religious rights, he has twice ruled in favor of an expansive view of religious rights of employers in questions of birth control, saying that the Affordable Care Act requirement that employer insurance cover birth control for women, that violates the religious conscience of the employer, they should not have to provide it. And that was the Hobby Lobby case. And it was
right.
The first time that when it went to the Supreme Court, his view was essentially vindicated. And it was the first time that the court had held that a generally applicable law can have a religious exemption for for-profit corporations. And in a separate case, he also ruled that the Little Sisters of the Poor should not have to provide an opt-out form to the federal government notifying the feds that they can't participate in this in the birth control program because it violates their religious conscience. And so that was his view. The Supreme Court eventually vacated the decision that he dissented from, actually, and it's sort of up in limbo. So he very likely will be a decisive vote if that case comes back to the Supreme Court.
So you say he's more like Scalia than Kennedy. What about this talk that Kennedy may be reassured about retiring now under President Trump because one of his clerks could become a Supreme Court justice? Is there anything to that?
I think only Justice Kennedy could tell you. But, you know, the idea is that he knows this man. He has a relationship with him. He actually flew to Denver to swear him in 2006 when he was named to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. They're friends. He's a protege of his. Justice Kennedy is a pretty conservative member of the court, just not on everything. And the one offsetting factor here might be his legacy on gay rights and same-sex marriage, which could be in jeopardy because of Neil Gorsuch's views on in the Hobby Lobby case would suggest again that, for example, people who operate a bakery or a whatever could decide that they don't want to serve somebody based on their religious views, that this is against their religious concepts. And so I don't think it would change anything. Certainly his being on the court doesn't change the 5-4 calculus that we have right now. But if Justice Kennedy were to retire, all of those things could be in play. Abortion, same-sex marriage, a lot of gay rights cases. A lot of things could be in play.
So we spoke with Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, who's on the Judiciary Committee earlier today. Here's what he told us.
All the signals are that he's not going to be a true judicial conservative. He instead is going to be another politically conservative activist and rebuild that 5-4 block that I think has been so bad for our country.
So, Nina, in the minute or so we have left, what do you think the chances that the Democrats will filibuster to stop Judge Gorsuch from being confirmed?
Well, I think they'll toy with the idea. Senator Schumer has already said there have to be 60 votes before there'll be a confirmation vote. But that means – all that means is that there have to be 8 Democrats who join all the Republicans. And already 6 are on the record as saying that they think there ought to be a vote. And I think there likely are more. So if you don't have the votes to have a real filibuster and block somebody, you only create weakness if you try to do it and fail. And then – then the question is, what do you do the next time? And there may be a second or a third or a fourth nomination, and you have to look down the road. And as mad as the Democrats are about the way the Republicans treated Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, I think in the end, Gorsuch likely will be confirmed, and he'll do it with the help of Democrats.
That's NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, let's check in now on a number of developments around sanctuary cities. These are cities that bar their local police from aiding federal officials in deporting undocumented immigrants, in part to maintain trust between their residents and local police. San Francisco is now suing the White House, saying President Trump's executive order to cut funding to sanctuary cities is unconstitutional and a violation of states' rights. Meanwhile, Democrats in the California Senate ramped up their effort to advance a bill that would provide statewide sanctuary for immigrants. And in Texas, a standoff between a county sheriff and the governor over sanctuary cities could come to a head tomorrow at the state capitol. Audrey McGlinchey from Here and Now contributor KUT in Austin reports.
Last week, roughly 30 advocates, immigrants, and lawyers crammed atop a ramshackle platform at an immigrants' rights office in North Austin. Two city council members squeezed in beside a U.S. congressman. The activists held signs reading, "United Against Fear and Hate," and "We Are Here to Stay," and they chanted,
"Aquí estamos y no nos vamos. Aquí estamos y no nos vamos."
"We're here and we're not going," chanted the activists. The last-minute news conference was called to show support for Travis County Sheriff Sally Hernandez. Elected by 60% of voters back in November, Hernandez began her new job on January 1st. And just 3 weeks later, she made a big announcement via a YouTube video.
"I'm Sally Hernandez, your Travis County Sheriff, and I would like to take this opportunity to explain how the Travis County Sheriff's Office will work to keep our community safe and coordinate with federal immigration authorities while respecting the constitutional and civil rights of the residents of Travis County."
Hernandez said she'll no longer honor warrantless requests from ICE, the federal immigration agency, to identify or detain immigrants who are undocumented, though she'll make an exception for requests for people charged with murder, aggravated sexual assault, or human smuggling. Hernandez said her policy builds trust between residents and deputies.
"The public must be confident that local law enforcement is focused on local public safety, not on federal immigration enforcement. Our jail cannot be perceived as a holding tank for ICE or that Travis County deputies are ICE officers."
But Hernandez's announcement quickly came under fire from Texas Governor Greg Abbott.
"We are going to crack down on this and ban sanctuary cities in Texas."
In an interview on Fox and Friends, Abbott cautioned against a policy that he says would threaten public safety in Texas.
"What she is doing under her plan, she would give sanctuary to people who are in the United States illegally, who've been convicted of crimes in the past, of heinous crimes like armed robbery. They could have been operating in conjunction with drug cartels, and she would not cooperate with ICE whatsoever."
Abbott has threatened to remove Hernandez from office if she does not comply with federal officials and change her policy. He's also vowed to push through a bill to punish local jurisdictions that pass sanctuary city policies.
"We are working on laws that will, one, ban sanctuary cities, remove from office any office holder who promotes sanctuary cities, impose criminal penalties as well as financial penalties."
One proposal, Senate Bill 4, would formalize the state's ability to cancel state funds to local jurisdictions that do not honor all federal immigration detainer requests. The bill gets its first public hearing tomorrow. Texas Senator Charles Perry authored the legislation. At a panel last week, he said the bill would be a way to codify the governor's concerns.
"It doesn't make any sense as a fiscal person for us to spend $800 million on border security that then go and reward cities that undermine that initiative as a state."
Some legal experts question the feasibility of cutting funds to the county, which operates independently of the sheriff's office. Stephanie Taylor is a private immigration lawyer.
For the state to threaten to cut county funds based on a sheriff's policy seems questionable legally.
There's no indication Sheriff Hernandez will budge on her policy. And she has some pretty vocal supporters, including Selena Moreno of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, who spoke at the press conference last week.
The state legislature will hear Senate Bill 4, which is exactly the type of legislation that interferes in local communities. And so we ask the community to please show up. Let's pack that hearing room and make it very clear where we stand as Texans on behalf of the immigrant community.
Senate Bill 4 already has widespread support among Republicans in the state Senate who hold a majority. But Governor Abbott has decided not to wait for the bill to pass. Just this morning, he canceled $1.5 million in state criminal justice grants to Travis County. For Here and Now, I'm Audrey McGlinchey in Austin.
Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to approve President Trump's pick for Attorney General Senator Jeff Sessions. The Senate Finance Committee approved the nomination of Steve Mnuchin to Treasury Secretary and Representative Tom Price to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Now they're all on to a full vote. And the president's Supreme Court choice, Judge Neil Gorsuch, is making the rounds in Washington after reportedly making his first call last night after his nomination to President Obama's failed court bid, Merrick Garland. Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor, has been looking at the landscape. Quick, Domenico, let's talk before something more happens.
Yeah, it is a busy time here in Washington, no question about it. And, you know, that's part of like Donald Trump putting out, you know, the Gorsuch nomination. It was sort of the first normal, traditional kind of rollout. And then this morning, he was back to tweeting about the travel ban, which he said, call it whatever you want, a ban, not a ban. We got to keep bad dudes
right
out.
Well, start with the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch. After the nomination, Dana Bash on CNN said, this is why evangelicals and conservatives back Trump. This nomination. Do you agree?
Oh, no question about it. I mean, it wasn't because they agreed with his moral foundation. You know, there were a lot
Trump's
of questions.
Yeah, yeah.
Trump's, right.
Yeah.
I mean, there were people we talked to all over the country who are evangelicals who said that they had real questions about Donald Trump's character, traits, temperament, marriages. But he gave them concrete reassurances of the kind of Supreme Court pick that he would put out. He put out two different lists. Gorsuch wasn't on the original list he put out, but was on the second one of 21 that he put out. And that was clearly enough for them. He won evangelicals by a huge margin. Republicans are rallying around this pick. And quite frankly, it's going to be very, very difficult for Democrats to stop if they want to do so, because this is somebody with impeccable legal credentials. Yes, he is conservative. Yes, he's been described by some in the mold of Scalia, an originalist. But this is a very traditional kind of pick. His temperament, his poise, he was approved by voice vote in the Senate in 2006. There's no question that there are controversial things that he has decided on. Democrats will want to pick that apart. They are girding for this fight. But whether or not they hold up the nomination to the point of trying to filibuster may be to their own detriment if they were to go that route. And that is what Democrats are discussing right now, because if they were to go that route on this pick, the threat here would be that Mitch McConnell would blow up the filibuster altogether, quote, go nuclear, which Donald Trump encouraged today if, quote, obstruction continued. So if that were to happen and they were to lose out on getting, fine, you get rid of Gorsuch. But if you get rid of Gorsuch, they'll have equally, if not more conservative pick in the same slot. And for the next one, there would be no 60 vote threshold.
Well, but, they may be thinking they've got nothing to lose because there may be more conservative anyway. So we'll see how that plays out. But meanwhile, the picks for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, expected to be confirmed. And I want to talk about the other nominees who were confirmed. But is Tillerson shaping up to be pretty straightforward?
Tillerson, again, because the filibuster was done away with by Democrats in 2013, they have no recourse to stop Tillerson's nomination. He is likely to be confirmed this afternoon. There are certainly a majority of Republicans. And that is going to be really interesting, because there were things that Rex Tillerson said he disagreed with Donald Trump on. But he's now going to be tasked with defending Donald Trump's worldview around the globe, and how he deals with that is going to be interesting to see. He was the former head of ExxonMobil. He has never been a world diplomat, even though he has, of course, many international ties around the world, managing the diplomatic bureaucracy with some unrest and unease within that bureaucracy. He's got a task ahead of him.
Well, and you've got the other two nominees confirmed by Senate committees, Mnuchin and Price. But Democrats tried to stop those votes by boycotting. Republicans on the committee changed the rules to ensure that would go ahead. That seems like a smart move for Republicans. But there's a lot of anger. You've got Democrats angry
Absolutely.
That Jason Chaffetz, the House Oversight Committee, has called for an investigation into the Ethics Committee that questioned Donald Trump's taxes, but not into investigating Donald Trump's conflicts of interest. What is the mood there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of Democrats who are absolutely outraged and Republicans who are excited about trying to get the agenda through, although getting more and more frustrated with Democrats who are trying to slow things down. Democrats, on the other hand, don't want government to exactly ground to a halt, but the liberal base is certainly pushing them to use whatever Senate procedural mechanisms possible to slow down any of Trump's nominees, even if in the end, they'll all be confirmed.
Okay. And just very, very briefly, we've got the Super Bowl coming up. There's an ad out by Budweiser. They tout, immigration. We're not going to hear it. You'll hear it all weekend. But it takes weeks to make an ad. Do people think that this is going to continue playing out into the Super Bowl, into ads?
There have been a lot of businesses who have been uneasy with the refugee and visa ban. A lot of businesses around the country, Silicon Valley in particular, where they depend on those kinds of waivers and visas for the kind of workforce they need around the globe. So you are going to see businesses continue along this line, most likely.
And Paris Lee, political editor. Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, when Hillary Clinton lost her bid to become the country's first female president, many political scientists thought it would discourage other women from running for office. So far, it appears that is not the case, at least in Pennsylvania, where women from both major political parties are clamoring to get involved in politics. Katie Colinari from Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
It's Sunday afternoon, and 25 women are sitting in a union hall in northeast Philadelphia. They're listening to a presentation on one of the first steps of running for elected office, filing petitions.
In practice, petitions are a grueling, terrible process during the worst three weather weeks of the year.
These women are here because of Emerge Pennsylvania. That's the state chapter of a national organization devoted to helping women who are Democrats run for office, with an intense six-month training in every aspect of campaigning, from door-knocking to fundraising. Executive Director Ann Wakabayashi says more than 100 women applied to this year's program, and the timing was notable.
My email comes to my phone, and so it was just buzzing constantly the day after Election Day with people signing up for our email list. We saw a bunch of likes on our Facebook page. We saw all this interest, and so I checked our application status, and I noticed that we had a couple more applications started, and it just kept going up and up and up.
So what's going on?
I feel like sometimes like a fire is welling up inside me, and you know, if I don't have a constructive outlet for it, I might go crazy.
Natasha Taylor Smith is an attorney from Montgomery County who's part of this year's Emerge Pennsylvania cohort. She ran for office in 2015 and lost. Then last fall, Taylor Smith volunteered for the Clinton campaign, and we all know how that turned out. Despite these setbacks, Taylor Smith says she's ready to dive back in.
I want to support candidates who I believe are progressive. I want to be a progressive candidate myself.
This was not what Dana Brown expected. Brown heads up the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics at Chatham University in Pittsburgh.
Many of us thought that if she lost the presidency, then that would have a chilling effect for women, that women would see perhaps how she was treated, perhaps negatively by the press or by other outlets. And that is just the complete opposite.
In fact, Brown's been getting flooded with inquiries for the university's bipartisan Ready to Run program coming up in February. For the first time, she had to create a wait list.
This is completely unprecedented for this program. I mean, the room literally is at capacity. We could be breaking fire codes if we allow any more women in.
If Brown sounds giddy about this phenomenon, she is. Here's why. Women make up 51% of Pennsylvania's population, but less than 20% of the state legislature. Studies have shown women face several barriers to running, including fears about fundraising and lack of party support. Brown says this new trend is being driven by Democrats, who are fired up after major party losses and the election of a polarizing president. But she is also seeing an uptick in the number of Republican women interested in running for office for the first time. On a recent weeknight, Michelle Roop was among the crowd of women at a restaurant in a strip mall in a suburb of Philadelphia. It was the monthly gathering of the Montgomery County Republican Women's Leadership Group. Roop was brought here by a friend who's recruited her to run for the local school board. And she's feeling rather uneasy.
Scared to death. I have absolutely no idea what I'm in for.
Roop was an early supporter of President Trump, and she thinks his surprise victory played a hand, albeit a subconscious one, in her decision to run.
I really thought about how different he was as a candidate, and he's not that classic politician. He's a businessman. I have my own small business. It really got me thinking that, you know, maybe politics isn't as scary or as difficult as what I thought it was, and maybe you really can keep your soul and still run and be an elected official.
Roop says having guidance and support from other Republican women who are energized by their party's big win is making her journey to the ballot easier. So what will it take to turn this influx of interest into election wins? Debbie Walsh leads the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers. She says the number of women in Congress and in state houses across the country has been stuck around 20% for several years.
The pace of progress has been glacially slow.
Walsh says that's because leaders of both the Republican and Democratic parties, many of them men, have not focused enough attention and resources on getting women to run. But after the so-called Year of the Outsider and the historic women's marches, Walsh says that might change.
Both parties try to think about how do they get more voters to the polls for their candidates, and if voters are looking for outsiders or for new faces, that women, in fact, in many cases, are those new faces.
For Here and Now, I'm Katie Culinary.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
It has been almost 2 weeks since Donald Trump's inauguration on January 20th, and that was the day by which he had promised to hand over management of his businesses to his sons. So, has he? Marilyn Geewax, NPR senior business editor, joins us now. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I did notice that both Don Jr. and Eric, his sons, were at the announcement last night at the White House for Judge Gorsuch. But what has happened to the management of Donald Trump's businesses since his inauguration?
Well, he had promised that he was going to change the management when he took office on January 20th. That was a Friday. But when journalists looked into it, there was no evidence that that had happened. Over the weekend, people were calling attention to that. So then on Monday, we here at NPR were looking at public records to see if there was paperwork showing that. And actually, the documents did start to turn up on Monday afternoon, and they showed exactly that, that the business was moving to the management of his sons. But here's the big but. The ethics experts that we talked to say that is a pretty meaningless change because, as you note, that the Trump family is very close. They're sort of same suit, different pockets. It's a family business that Trump continues to own. It has operations in about 20 countries. So there are always going to be these controversies that pop up because Mr. Trump has a role as president, but he also has this role as a business owner, and it comes into conflict a lot of times.
Well, one of the conflicts that's come up has to do with the new hotel that he built in the old post office building in Washington. What's happening there? Mm-hmm.
Just a couple of days ago, the workers there joined a union, so there are going to be contract negotiations. So at the same time that the Trump sons are going to be wrangling with the union over a contract, Trump the father will have the ability to appoint the majority of members of the National Labor Relations Board, which, you know, plays a role in enforcing collective bargaining and making decisions about contracts. So critics say that if you end up in some kind of a contract dispute with the labor board, how can the hotel workers feel that they're getting a fair shake if they know that Trump the father determined the makeup of that board?
Meanwhile, the Red Cross, Maryland, is dealing with a headache right now. It's holding a ball at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort this weekend and is expecting to get a lot of protesters. And the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute is also getting criticism connected to a Mar-a-Lago event later this month. What's happening there?
Well, this shows how these controversies spill over into another area, charities. This is blowing up right now that Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has gotten, you know, people, hundreds of medical students, doctors, all these health professionals are saying that they should not hold this fundraiser on February 18th at Mar-a-Lago. That's Trump's club in South Florida. But Dana-Farber doesn't want to cancel it because last year they raised $2.2 million there. And then they put a lot of effort into putting this thing together. So here's examples of how Trump's continued ownership of his business is just throwing off these controversies that come up. And now it's this club ownership is injecting politics into something that should be a unifying cause, fighting cancer.
Well, I imagine that just to avoid all of the politics, a lot of people are going to decide to just have their event at the Breakers, which is the other big resort in Palm Beach.
Maryland, let's sit on the beach.
That's right. Marilyn G. Wax, NPR Senior Business Editor. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
And now a story that might make you wonder, what would I do? In 1995, a Catholic priest in Florida signed a Declaration of Life, essentially a letter that he wrote and had notarized, saying in part, "I hereby declare that should I die as a result of a violent crime, I request that the person or persons found guilty of homicide for my killing not be subject to the death penalty under any circumstance, no matter how heinous the crime or how much I suffered." This is a so-called Declaration of Life created by the anti-capital punishment group, the Cherished Life Circle, founded decades ago by the Sisters of Mercy in New York. Well, 21 years after writing his declaration, Father Rene Robert of St. Augustine, Florida, was murdered in Georgia, allegedly by Stephen Murray, an ex-con Father Rene was trying to rehabilitate. Murray confessed to the crime, and it was a heinous act. Father Rene probably did suffer. Former District Attorney Ashley Wright was the prosecutor on the case. She's since been sworn in as a judge, but she said one of the reasons she sought the death penalty against Murray was that the slaying was outrageously vile, horrible, or inhuman. Still, Father Rene's friends and family are fighting to make sure his wishes are honored and that the life of the man now charged with his murder is spared. Joining us, one of Father Robert's closest friends, Father Edward Rooney. And first, Father, we're sorry for your loss.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, yeah. Indeed.
And do I understand you were part of a group of Catholic leaders that held a news conference yesterday outside the county courthouse in Augusta, Georgia, where the murder is alleged to have occurred? What did you want to get across there?
Well, first of all, we brought our petitions with us, okay? There were 7,400 petitions signed by people in the area and the churches, you know, congregation members. And so these petitions were brought to Augusta yesterday, and there were three bishops present, and there was a number of clergy and other people, supporters. So we presented our petitions to the district attorney. So we haven't heard yet which way he is going to go. He's going to go for the death penalty or if he's going to hold off. We haven't heard.
Well, we should say the letter doesn't have a legal standing, right?
It probably doesn't, no. But it has been notarized by a judge in St. Augustine, and I don't think that adds anything to it. But it doesn't have any legal standing, no.
But you're saying it was notarized back in 1995. Because obviously Father Robert wanted to leave this to be found. And he did work with people who were troubled, including the man who's suspected of murdering him. Stephen Murray is accused of kidnapping Father Robert, forcing him to the trunk of a car, and then driving him from Florida to Georgia and murdering him. And Stephen Murray was one of the many ex-cons that Father Robert devoted his life to. People had warned Father Robert, didn't they, that he was, it was, this was risky business.
Yes, yes, I think he knew the risk. But he was a very mild-mannered individual, and he was, I guess he was willing to take the risk.
Why? What was his goal?
Well, he was, first of all, he was a Franciscan brother at one time, early on, and then he became a priest. So I guess it was his Franciscan, the followers of St. Francis, the Franciscans, their modus operandi, so to speak, is one of compassion and care for the people who are on the margins. Yeah. And so that was his, that was ingrained into him, so to speak. And he was a very mild-mannered individual and very caring and very loving. And but again, he was blind to a certain extent to some of the risks that might be involved yeah. when you reach out to people like this.
Well, again, and one of them was Steve Murray, who's now accused of kidnapping and murdering him. And we have some sound of him walking out of the courtroom last April, speaking to WALB, the TV station in Georgia. And he obviously knew of what Father Rene, as he called him, or Father Robert stood for, this idea of forgiveness. Let's listen.
If anybody really loves Father Rene, they'll forgive me because he was a man of God, and forgiveness is forgiveness. I have mental problems, and I lost control of myself, and I apologize.
So the suspect now, sort of, some would say, playing on Father Robert's sympathies and the sympathies of, you know, people who might support Father Roberts. Does that bother you at all that an accused murderer might be playing on your sympathies?
Well, you know, it's possible, I suppose, but we don't see it that way. We look at the other side of it, whereas justice has to be tempered by mercy. So we, as Catholic Christians, we're not in favor of the death penalty, and there's been, certainly the mood in the country is changing, I think. So our purpose really is that the death penalty would not be pursued regardless, but that he would be given the maximum sentence, which would be imprisonment and life without parole. Mm-hmm. And if he did intend to kind of bring some leverage, so to speak, to the situation, we didn't see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, others could say he was the voice of Father Robert speaking through him.
Well, I'm sure Father Robert, Father Rene himself would have, you know, he would have certainly given Murray a message of forgiveness. I'm sure he would have encouraged him to stay on the straight and narrow, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he wouldn't have been blasé about it. Yeah. He would have encouraged him to straighten out and get his life in order.
Well, the Augusta District Attorney is Hank Sims. He was just sworn into office yesterday when you and others held this press conference and presented the petition with thousands of signatures asking for this letter from Father Rene to be considered. He said he had a cordial conversation, but he didn't indicate any decision. Meanwhile, this is really kind of an incredible story. What do you think happened here? Do you think Father Rene in 1995 was being prescient? You know, about what do you think happened? Writing a letter, if I should be murdered, forgive my murder, and then he's murdered.
Yeah, right. Yes, indeed. It's most unusual. I've never heard of such a thing happening. In fact, I've never heard of this declaration of life statement that you call his letter, which really was a statement. It was called a declaration of life statement, and it's that we don't want to be seen as people who harbor harbor vengeance, okay? And we don't want to see that happening. And therefore, it's one of mercy. So, yeah, it's most unusual. I've never heard of it before, and especially now that it actually did happen. I think, you know, it's certainly a precedent setting circumstance.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you think you'll ever write one?
Do I think I will write one? Mm. Yeah, I've definitely been thinking about it. And I think there might be a push in our diocese or whatever. There might be a push to get people to sign this kind of a statement. And it would be very, very good. And this is just a thought that I have myself, that it would be great if, say, some state legislatures would offer a bill or a law that would honor statement, the declaration of life statement that, that Father René had made, you know, that they would, this would be honored in the courts. That that would be a great thing. I think it would be. It would certainly be a great thing for our country and for justice. Yes, and for life. Yes.
That's Father Edward Rooney, close friend of Father René Robert of St. Augustine, Florida, who wrote one of these Declaration of Life saying he did not want anybody, he didn't want his death to result in capital punishment for another human being, and he was killed. Father Rooney, thank you so much for speaking to us about it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Well, at least one lawmaker in Georgia is also calling for a rethinking, if not a repeal, of the death penalty. State Rep. Brett Harrell is a member of the newly launched group Georgia Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. At a press conference last month, he said, in addition to being opposed to the death penalty as a man of faith,
as a fiscally conservative Republican, I am mindful of how we spend our taxpayers' dollars. The death penalty, without fail, has been proven across this nation, study after study, to be a more expensive alternative to life without the ability of parole. So again, I have concluded that life without parole is the proper choice, the correct choice, that renders the death penalty unnecessary.
Now, we've been tracking the death penalty usage in recent months. In December, we learned from the Death Penalty Information Center that there was another record decline in 2016, although Georgia carried out the most executions last year. So what should Georgia do now? If the state finds Stephen Murray guilty of murdering Father René, should they put Murray to death against Father René's wishes, which he expressed over 20 years ago?
Let's get more reaction to President Trump's nomination of appeals court judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. We spoke with Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, and if you missed that interview on air, you can catch it at hereandnow.org. Joining us now is legal scholar Douglas Kamek, a professor at Pepperdine University School of Law in California. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So what's your reaction to Neil Gorsuch?
I think it is an extremely strong pick on the part of the president. It's one that reflects the commitment of the president's party to having jurists do the work of judges as opposed to legislators. And Judge Gorsuch, even as young as he is, has had a very well-rounded set of experiences as a lawyer in private practice with a distinguished firm. With over 10 years of experience on the appellate bench, as an active litigator himself, and as a legal philosopher. He's someone who has thought deeply about the law and who expresses himself in a way that is not partisan, but rather intellectual and dedicated to the improvement of the justice system. So all around, he's quite a superb pick.
Well, we spoke with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat on the Judiciary Committee, about Gorsuch, and he says the question will be, is Gorsuch a judicially conservative judge or a politically conservative activist? What do you think the answer is?
I think the answer is clear that he is a judicially conservative judge. He is someone who is not unlike Judge Merrick Garland, who, while perhaps having a different set of life experiences and would point him in a somewhat different direction on a few issues, I think both of the men would approach their responsibilities as very carefully articulating the difference between judges and lawmakers and giving great deference to lawmakers, but also expecting lawmakers to not just delegate their responsibilities to administrative agencies, but rather to actually make the tough policy choices, allowing judges to read the law as the lawmakers have decided upon it. So I don't think he's going to bring his personal political views. There's no evidence of that in his judicial writing or in his other remarks.
Where do you think he would fit on the court? Some have said he would be less conservative than Clarence Thomas, but more than Samuel Alito. Do you agree with that?
I think he's going to be closer to and this may distress some of the conservatives out there, but I think he's going to be closer to Justice Kennedy. After all, he did clerk for Justice Kennedy, and I think he shares some of the same structural concerns that Justice Kennedy has. And by structural, I mean those features of the Constitution that divide power in a way to ensure that it's accountable, that it's transparent, that it's coincident with the rule of law as opposed to the political preferences of the moment. So while it's always hard to predict, and presidents have been disappointed when they have tried to predict the particular votes on particular cases, I think the thing that you get with Judge Gorsuch is a straight shooter, someone who reads the law, going to read the briefs, going to hear the arguments and decide cases on their facts. So in that sense, I think he's more likely to be inclined to be an Anthony Kennedy style, who has his mind open and is not necessarily planted firmly on the left or the right, but planted more conspicuously on the law in the center.
Well, so obviously we can never know how a justice would rule on a case exactly. But do you think, since you're comparing him to Justice Kennedy, that, for example, in the same-sex marriage decision, that he would have also been with the majority as Kennedy was in that case?
You know, he has not spoken, as you mentioned, to that issue. And I suspect in the confirmation hearing he will say that it's inappropriate for him to do so until an individual case arises. But I do think the same set of considerations about liberty and about due process and about equal protection will animate his choice in an issue such as that.
One more thing I want to ask you about, and that is that there is something that is different about Judge Gorsuch than the other justices on the court. He's Protestant, and the rest are Catholic and Jewish. Does that make a difference?
No, I don't think it does. I don't think it makes a difference for any member of the court, and properly so. I think Judge Gorsuch understands that there is no religious or test oath that governs his judicial activity, nor should it. I think that is it's, of course, always good to have a diversity of life experiences on the court. But as to the imposition of religious values into judicial work, I don't think that is going to be a significant factor whatsoever.
That's Douglas Kamek, who is a professor at Pepperdine University School of Law in California. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.